Principles of Economics, My Complete Guide to Understanding Economics, is now available in hardcover, audiobook, and ebook from SaifEddin.com, Amazon, and many more booksellers worldwide. And now, I am also teaching a course based on this book on my website, SaifEddin.com. Principles of Economics will run the whole academic year, from September to June, and will have a new lecture every 2 weeks, as well as weekly live online discussion seminars open to learners from all over the world and from all walks of life. Whether you're a student, a professional, or a retiree, you are making economic decisions every day, and this course will arm you with the wisdom of centuries of economists to improve your economic decision-making. You'll also get a free book of Principles of Economics if you sign up for the course. Go to SaifEddin.com and sign up now. The Bitcoin Standard Podcast is brought to you by Orange Pill App, the Bitcoin-only social network that connects you with high-signal Bitcoiners, events, and now merchants as well. If you're like me and can't stop talking about Bitcoin, you know how challenging it can be to talk to the no-coiners and how nice it is to talk to someone who gets you. With the Orange Pill app, you can find the Bitcoiners near you and they can replace the no-coiners in your life. You can organize events and meetups with local Bitcoiners, and wherever you travel, you can meet up with local Bitcoiners all while being as anonymous as you like. So if you want to build your local network of Bitcoiners, find a Bitcoin meetup or merchants accepting Bitcoin, head over to orangepillapp.com to sign up or download the app from the App Store or Google Play Store and send me a DM so we can get connected. The Bitcoin Standard Podcast is brought to you by CoinKite. CoinKite are my favorite makers of Bitcoin hardware. They produce the legendary OpenDime, the first Bitcoin bearer asset, as well as the reliable Cold Card hardware wallet, the excellent stainless steel seed plates for storing your seed phrases, and the block clock. Now, CoinKite have produced the Sats card, a card the size of a credit card which can store Bitcoin and works great as a gift. CoinKite have just produced a limited edition gorgeous Bitcoin Standard Sats card, which carries the Bitcoin Standard logo, and you can get it from coinkite.shop/Bitcoin Standard. Use the code Bitcoin Standard to get 5% off your purchase. This podcast is also brought to you by the Bitcoin Way, your professional Bitcoin IT team offering you personalized, secure, and comprehensive solutions for every step along your Bitcoin journey. The Bitcoin Way offer live concierge service to guide you with your Bitcoin cold storage, running your node, privacy best practices, inheritance planning, corporate strategy, and multi-sig solutions. They don't touch your coins, they guide you through the process of acquiring your coins and securing them. If you'd like to make your setup safer and more reliable, book a consult with them and see what they have to suggest. If you want to give someone the gift of Bitcoin, get them this professional service that will ensure they start off knowing exactly how to manage their coins and not lose them. Go to thebitcoinway.com and start Bitcoining more confidently.
Your first time in Asia, what'd you think?
Hong Kong is an amazing city in many ways. It reminds me in many ways of Switzerland and Lebanon as being small independent countries surrounded by bigger countries that have more government and more repressive regimes. But here you have more of free market spirit, and you can see the difference, and it's quite striking. So I've definitely enjoyed that. Hong Kong always ranks at the top of the Global Economic Freedom Index, at the top or near the top. So I was always curious to come and see what it looks like. I'm very happy to be here.
Very good. All right. So trying to think, where do we begin? Let's start off on a little bit of interesting, hopefully funny note, in that I was spending a lot of time with you over at the conference when I was sitting at your table where you were selling your book, and a couple of interesting things happened. And one of them was, we now have to be careful the way we say what currencies we are accepting. Like, what currencies were you accepting for your book?
Yeah, I had the misfortune of saying, because I took cash as well as Bitcoin. And so I said Bitcoin cash. And people thought, so I don't believe any rumors about me accepting Bitcoin cash. It was a misunderstanding. I firmly deny all of the allegations.
Right. So you got to be careful of how you say like, well, what can I pay you in? And you got to make sure you have to say cash first. Cash or Bitcoin or, well, PayPal, which is cash.
Yes.
So we found that very, very hilarious. And the other part was, and yeah, try to speak up for the people in the back.
Oh, okay.
The other part was, when people pay you with Bitcoin, which is, by the way, scannable on the cover of the book, the QR code there is scannable. When they pay you, the moment they hit the send button, do you wait for confirmations?
No, actually, my phone had broken as soon as I arrived in Hong Kong. And so not only could I not verify the transactions on a full node, I couldn't even verify them on a regular Block Explorer. But my my security strategy was that if somebody could double spend a transaction and fake a transaction, you know, then that makes the book practically worthless anyway. So obviously they're not going to do it. And it worked. Everybody who took a book paid for it. And eventually the transactions cleared. I counted the books and the number of transactions. None of the Bitcoiners double spent in order to take the Bitcoin standard. So that's good.
Yeah, it's funny when you were saying that, when you said, well, if you were able to double spend me, I mean, first of all, you deserve the book for free.
That's true.
And you probably wouldn't want it in that case. All right, so that was great. So let's talk about that freedom aspect of Hong Kong, because yeah, one of the things that I love about Hong Kong, maybe I shouldn't say this on camera, is these octopus cards, which is like instant NFC value transfer, which is cash and which is anonymous, and they can go up to somewhat high amounts. How does Bitcoin compete with that?
It doesn't. It really doesn't. I think there's no reason why you couldn't build something like this on top of Bitcoin. And I think these are completely separate categories of function, essentially technological function. In other words, Bitcoin, in my opinion, and the thesis of my book, is that it's not going to grow as a payment network where people are going to be using it for individual transactions. Most likely, because of the high level of security that the network provides, and the certainty and the speed with which it is able to finalize settlement, not transaction, but settlement, final settlement, that I think makes it more akin to the kind of transactions that take place between large financial institutions, rather than the transactions that take place between consumers and sellers and so on. In other words, if you think about it, when you when I was selling the book for Bitcoin, it's really unworkable, other than the fact that it's a book about Bitcoin in a Bitcoin conference. But it's generally really unworkable. You can't have a giant supermarket handling thousands of clients every day and, having to wait for one confirmation at least. And even one confirmation is arguably not enough when you're handling very mass volumes. So in terms of instant settlement of payments or small level of payments that don't require a very high level of security, Bitcoin is quite inferior. On the other hand, if you think about it, comparing it to large settlement payments between large financial institutions around the world, you know, there is absolutely nothing that compares to it. It's Bitcoin settles money that is free of liability and free of obligation. In other words, it's best comparable to a settlement of payment in gold, in physical gold, moving physical gold from one location to the other, because physical gold before Bitcoin was the only form of money that was effectively free of any encumbrance or liability. Its value was independent of anybody meeting an obligation, like, say, government money or other kinds of money that are dependent on debt or credit in general. So moving gold around really is the ultimate value transfer. So under the gold standard, you know, the individual transactions took place between individuals, but they were backed by physical gold that was in vaults, and the gold moved rarely compared to when the instruments that were backed by the gold were moving, which was more frequently. And so from this perspective, we see the speed of the transaction is not really suitable for immediate transactions, but it is far more suitable for the large scale transactions, because it is because it can carry out international settlement and finalize it with a form of cash money. In other words, not credit money, but cash, which was historically the term used to refer to gold reserves. So you can move cash reserves from one part of the world to the other. With Bitcoin, you know, we can get 6 confirmations in about 1 hour, which is a very high level of finality. And, you know, if you wait a couple of hours more, you get much, much higher level of certainty. So in that sense, I think we need to think of the scaling of Bitcoin as being a growth in the value of transactions and not a growth in the number of transactions that Bitcoin carries out. So Bitcoin, likely, because the transactions continue to perform, you know, the blocks continue to include only valid transactions. There's no disputing of the record. We've not had successful double spends. We've not had any reorgs of the chain that reversed actual spending transactions or any actual confirmation that was given then turned out to be double spent. It hasn't happened yet. You know, the more this carries on, the larger the value of transactions that take place. And eventually, the more secure the network is, if it continues to prove itself in the long run in the security, you would expect that higher and higher value transactions will take place. And we already see this now in terms of the scaling and the growth and development of Bitcoin. Because if you look at most Bitcoin transactions, they effectively take place off-chain. In other words, if you think of an exchange, you know, when you send money into the exchange, when you send Bitcoin to the exchange, and when you take Bitcoin out, are possibly the only times that the exchange makes a transaction with Bitcoin on the Bitcoin blockchain. But all the rest of the transactions that take place on the exchange or on many of the gambling websites or betting websites that operate on Bitcoin, most of these transactions take place on the ledgers of third parties, essentially. So it's already beginning to look like we're going to see more and more second layer solutions that will take that will provide solutions for different degrees of security for lower security requirements for transactions. It doesn't make sense, of course, that, you know, all of this giant energy consumption for Bitcoin, you know, it doesn't make sense to be going on individually small transactions. It will never scale. But if it's for large transactions that are each settling much larger number of individual transactions, then the economies of scale of it, I think, will eventually kick in and it will start making sense. And that's, if Bitcoin is to scale, this is how I imagine its scaling happening. And that's why the title of my book is the Bitcoin Standard, in reference to the gold standard, because that's effectively how gold scaled. Now, okay, I think that's enough. All right. Let me take a break, yeah.
All right, so you did mention mining a little bit. So here's another question. I'm trying to come up with new questions because Saif and I talk all the time. And I do recommend you guys read the book, so I want to deviate from the book a little bit. And do you think the price of Bitcoin matters and how much? This is both as a monetary historian and as an economist.
Yeah, absolutely. And I will say, as a monetary historian and economist, and even as somebody just looking at the way Bitcoin functions, the price matters for Bitcoin from a technical
perspective. Because a lot of people say the price doesn't matter.
No. The price does matter. The price is really the most important metric of Bitcoin's growth, really. Everything else is not as strong an indicator as the price. Let's face it. You know, it's not... It's not that it's supposed to go very quick or that there is any specific rate that we need to put on it. But ultimately, the price is really important because the price is what determines the amount of economic value in the network, and therefore it determines how much people value the services that the network provides. And that, in turn, determines the value of the rewards that go to the miners. And therefore, that determines how much energy and electricity goes into securing the chain. And so as the price rises, the chain becomes more expensive to attack and therefore more secure. And so if Bitcoin is to grow, it needs to continue to grow in terms of its price, just from a purely technical perspective. Like if the price of Bitcoin tomorrow drops to $100, it's likely going to become much cheaper to attack the chain. Bitcoin's level of security is likely to be degraded. From an economic perspective as well, you know, Bitcoin, it's, you know, the performance over the last 10 years in the price has been astonishing. And that's why people really pay attention. Let's face it. I mean, people didn't just suddenly become database enthusiasts in 2010, you know. There wasn't the global outbreak of, oh, wow, you know, distributed ledgers are the cool thing. You know, that's not what was driving all the attention. That we've had distributed ledgers for 30 years, 40 years, and they were never cool. It was the price that made them cool. It was the fact that they were used for issuing a monetary system, a monetary asset that was verifiably scarce. And that is what gave this concept value and made this idea extremely viral. And ultimately, you know, it matters because the role of money essentially is about the storing of value and the transfer of value across time and across space. And so if Bitcoin's price plummets too much, then yeah, it's arguably not going to be attractive as a store of value. And now how much, of course, is obviously subjective in this regard, but in a sense, you know, people can have all their own realizations and all their own perspectives about it. But really what Bitcoin needs to do is not meet anyone's subjective value of what you think the price should be for Bitcoin to succeed. It needs to just continue to make the price high enough for it to continue to be secure, for it to not be attacked, for it to not be degraded in its security. And then, you know, that on its own, I think, securing its survival ultimately is what matters and will make the price likely rise and make the demand for Bitcoin increase over time.
All right. So you touched on it a little bit. I'm not going to I know you get this a lot and it's very frustrating because I do as well. So since the whole value proposition began as this censorship-resistant, unconfiscatable value transfer, why do people continue to believe in other decentralized ledgers pretending to be money with infinite inflation?
I don't know. Ask them.
The answer was, I don't know. Ask them. Okay, so let's change gears a little bit. So I know all of you are going to go out and read Save's book, and we do have a live audience, and people will watch this on video. So if you were to rewrite the book, it's been what now, 2.5 years since you finished?
No, it's been out for 11 months.
But you finished it like probably like 6 months
ago? Yeah, about almost a year.
Okay, so about a year. If you were to rewrite the book, what chapter would you add and what would that be about?
The syllabus for my new online economics course, Principles of Economics, is now available on saifeddin.com. The course will take place over 18 lectures, each based on one chapter from my new book, Principles of Economics, which will be available for free as an ebook for everyone registering for the course. Lectures will be released once every 2 weeks on Mondays, starting on the 25th of September, 2023, and will be available in video and audio format. Live discussion seminars will be held once a week on Thursdays at alternating time slots, 12 hours apart, to ensure learners can attend from all over the world. I'm happy to announce that I have set up my new publishing house and online bookstore, The Safe House, which will be publishing and delivering the best Bitcoin and Austrian economics books worldwide in hardcover, audiobook, and ebook formats. Go to thesafehouse.com to buy my latest book, Principles of Economics, as well as the Fiat Standard and the Bitcoin Standard. And now I'm also publishing Fiat Food, Matthew Lisiak's amazing investigation into how inflation ruined our diet and health. And I'm also publishing Lynn Alden's Broken Money, her masterful exploration of the failures of the global financial system and how Bitcoin fixes it. This is a Bitcoiner's bookshop, so the books are printed in beautiful cloth hardcover made to last, with an ice-colored dust jacket on top. Go to thesafehouse.com and get yours now.
I really don't think I want to rewrite it. It was a product of its time.
Well, if you were to write it now, what chapter would you add?
I think, you know, what I'm doing right now is essentially I'm adding a second part to the book. I'm adding new chapters on more economic topics, essentially like the more advanced treatment of the topic. So, you know, my book was, if you look at it, it's 10 chapters, but the first 7 chapters barely mention Bitcoin at all. They rarely even mention the word Bitcoin. They're all about the history of money and how money has operated over history, and you know how we went from the gold standard to government control of money, and how that evolved over time, and why Bitcoin can potentially be a compelling solution to this problem. So then there was the part that explains Bitcoin, but then you know the book would have gotten a little too long to get into more economic questions, I think, about Bitcoin. But that's what I'm doing right now. I'm planning on writing producing a second book soon, and it's going to be individual chapters, each one tackling an individual topic related to Bitcoin. That wouldn't quite have fit with the Bitcoin standard, which is a more of a monograph. It's a book with its own flow, where the chapters follow one another. But I think, you know, the second thing now is to just go over individual topics. For instance, Bitcoin's energy consumption, how much energy Bitcoin consumes, and what that means, and what's likely to what likely impact Bitcoin will have on the energy market. Yeah, this is what I'm interested in writing right now.
And you want to give us a little more detail on that?
Okay.
Like dig into that topic a little bit more, because that's one of the ways that Bitcoin gets demonized by the proof of stakers, is that you people with consumption of energy, you're going to destroy the planet, just like your meat eating is going to destroy the planet, which we'll also maybe get into if we have time before the Q&A. How do you fight that? How do you explain reality of the situation and capitalism?
Yeah, well, you know, people need to stop thinking about energy as being such an emotionally charged topic. You know, energy is essentially the way that we are able to survive the winter and that we are able to move around. In modern life and modern our ability to survive and live long lives that are safe from the environment depends to a very large degree on access to high amounts of energy, you know, and a lot of power. So, you know, the concept that we have some sort of scarcity of energy, or that energy is limited in any way, is a misconception of what energy is. The amount of solar energy that falls on Earth every hour is, I think, larger than the amount of energy that all humanity consumes over a whole year. The amount of, you know, energy in all of the rivers around the world that is flowing, all of the wind that is blowing, all the fossil fuels, all the nuclear energy, there is a limitless amount of energy all around us. The problem, however, is in finding ways of channeling that energy towards ends that are productive for us, towards things that we value, towards things that we find to be important. And so, you know, human progress is when we are able to, it will really happen with the use of higher amounts of energy over the last couple of hundred years, through our ability to utilize, you know, things like fossil fuels, gas and coal and oil. We can burn them, and then we can produce an enormous amount of work. You know, they can move things around, they can warm things, they can allow us to build things that we couldn't build before. And that's what allows us to have our modern life. So if you think about it, this is really how modern life is possible. We move from methods of doing things that are low energy intensity to methods that are safer, faster, more productive, and cleaner, that involve higher amounts of energy. And, you know, the best example is cars. You know, we think of cars as being dirty, but we don't understand the alternative is not some, you know, Star Trek fictional car moving vehicle that just operates seamlessly and runs on water and produces nothing but rainbows and unicorns. The alternative to cars is horses. And if you have horses, that means, you know, streets full of horse excrement. So, you know, there's a reason we don't use horses anymore. Nobody lives in cities that run on horses, because having a car, as dirty as you think it might be, is a better solution than horses. That's essentially the same story with all methods of transport, with all method of, you know, central heating. It's central heating is far more energy intensive. We burn electricity, and then we burn resources to produce electricity to send it over wires and send it large distances, and a lot of conversion loss. but we produce homes that are very warm, but it consumes a lot of energy. But so what happens is, as quality of life increases, energy consumption increases. The correlation across the world is absolutely ironclad. You know, the countries that have high, the countries that have absolute poverty, all have low energy consumption. The countries that have no poverty at all have high energy consumption. This is just the brute reality of life, you know. And if you really want to understand what it means, try and think of surviving for 1 year without consuming fossil fuels or hydrocarbons. Just think about what it would take for you to survive 1 year without having any form of access to anything produced from those things or all of the energy that these things allow us. So the notion that consuming more energy is in any way bad is just a misconception of what energy is. More energy consumption is what makes our life better. And anybody who says this is only capable of saying this because our lives today have been so enriched through so much energy consumption that we don't even understand how much energy goes into producing those things. You know, people think that, you know, when they talk about reducing their fossil fuel consumption from cows or from cow methane production, you know, it's absolutely a trivial compared to just the stuff that is needed for your basic survival through the winter. You know, in order for you to live in a modern city, the power plant that burns massive amounts of fossil fuels almost all over the world, you know, the majority of fuels are coal, gas, and oil. That's the reality. That's how we're able to maintain cities that in which millions of people can survive. Sure, some places have nuclear and some places have hydro, but the majority of energy is hydrocarbons. And, you know, the whatever you feel about this is completely inconsequential compared to your actual market choices. Look at what your house consumes, look at what your car consumes, look at what your airplane consumes, and look at the alternatives. You know, next time you want to cross the Pacific, take the energy-friendly alternative and use your kayak instead of an airplane and see how that goes, you know? Which one is more convenient and which one is more, you know, useful for you to cross the Pacific. So for me, Bitcoin is just the automation of another of the functions of central banks. In other words, it's the way in which we use high amounts of energy in order to make a job that necessitated human labor before done automatically. You know, just like we took out the operator from the telephone before and we made telephones run automatically. Now we have a technology that allows the final settlement layer of banking and the monetary supply, so the payment clearance and money supply, essentially the two main functions of a central bank, we can do them electronically. We can do them with cold, hard machinery. We don't have to have human beings handling them. They can be done simply with machines burning electricity and hashing power. That's essentially how it is. So whether this is good or bad, ultimately, is not something for you and I to pass judgment upon. In the same way that any kind of a new invention is not up for you and me to, you know, run a vote on it. There is a real voting mechanism that takes place, which is the market economy, which is people choose whether they prefer to use horses or cars. And, you know, the reality of your choice with your spending is far more, you know, far more important than whatever you feel about which energy sources and what their emotional ramifications for you are. So the reality is Bitcoin is going to be a technology that's going to allow us to consume much higher amounts of energy towards the production of monetary policy. But the misconception here is to think of it as being consumption, as if we have this fixed amount of energy in the world and that Bitcoin is going to eat it. What's happening is, if anybody here follows mining, you know, the most important lesson I think that miners learn after a few years of mining is that if you, and most of them doesn't take a few years, usually a few months, if you have electricity, if you're mining with electricity rates that are generally easy to obtain around the world, you're not going to be profitable mining Bitcoin because of something called the difficulty adjustment, which is my favorite part of Bitcoin, basically. It's the fact that mining continues to get harder so that to ensure that the money supply stays constant, right? I don't think we have too much time to get into the details, but the basic idea is that the difficulty adjustment continues to make it so that it's only profitable for the most economical miners to mine, and because it continues to make it more difficult to mine as more people enter. So if you're mining at electricity rates that are easily available around the world, even if you're making a profit now, all that's going to happen is that a lot more people are going to start mining at that rate, and so you're going to lose money. So the people that have been able to make profit consistently on mining are the people who are able to secure energy resources at significantly low rates. And the only place where you can secure those things are in places in which residents and commercial and industrial uses are not competing for that electricity. So if you have a power plant near a major city, you know, consumers want to have electricity to watch TV, to be warm, to survive the winter, to move around. So they're going to bid the price of electricity up to a point that will make Bitcoin mining unprofitable. But if you have a power, if you have some source of energy, like a waterfall or a, any source of energy that is away from civilization, away from cities where it can be utilized massively, well, now you have a way of monetizing it. You have a way of turning it into money by using it to mine Bitcoin. So what Bitcoin allows effectively is the mining of the use of energy resources from anywhere around the world where they're stranded and isolated and not cheap to utilize and bring towards the centralized locations where or the cities where people want to use them. That energy can be used for Bitcoin mining. So effectively, hydroelectric energy sources, as well as the particularly the flare-up energy from oil wells. In oil wells, they get a lot of methane that they can't transport to cities because transporting it is more expensive than it is worth. So what do? They burn it. And if you, instead of burning it, if you use it to mine Bitcoin, you can turn it into money effectively. So the same thing happens with the hydroelectric power plants. So Bitcoin is effectively driving investment in energy consumption, in energy production, particularly in energy production in resources that are away from population centers. So therefore diversifying our energy sources and increasing the amount of energy resources that are off the grid. And so decentralizing energy markets, and perhaps most amazingly, creating a global energy liquid, global market for energy that is liquid. In other words, wherever you are in the world, you can sell energy through Bitcoin. Just get a Bitcoin miner and turn the energy into Bitcoins. And so it's essentially what Bitcoin is doing is that it's putting a bid under electricity for, no matter how cheap electricity is, Bitcoin is there to, it can you turn it into money for you. And so it's subsidizing the production of electricity. And so if you're adding an enormous amount of demand to new electricity production, what is that going to lead to? More capital investment in electricity, therefore more electricity production, and therefore lower marginal cost of electricity. So I think the long run impact of Bitcoin is going to be a massive development of sustainable and renewable energy sources, particularly stranded energy resources all over the world, particularly off the grid in areas that are not connected to major population or residential centers.
All right. Very cool. All right. I got one more question for you, and then we will go over to Q&A. So I would like to, as I'm always fascinated by this topic because it has changed my life slightly over the last year or so that I've known you. And you started doing presentations on it already. You've been making a connection between easy money and easy dietary choices. So let me give you about 5 minutes to introduce a new topic. Hopefully it will be a book out of it one day.
A chapter.
And, maybe a chapter.
At least in the start.
So how do we, because everyone always wants to, we do our carnivory dinners. We had one last night. And vegetarians were welcome, but it was explained why that's not a good idea. But so what is the connection between Bitcoin, carnivory, and easy money versus easy dietary choices?
So I think, you know, the coincidence, if you've noticed, is quite large. There's a quite coincidence. I think, you know, you can't just explain it as a coincidence. And I think there are several reasons for this. Ultimately, what I think it comes down to is the ability of governments to control the money supply has allowed them to have a very large influence on the control of the food supply. And they have, you know, part of the way in which they have sought to hide inflation is to tell people to eat things that are cheaper to produce with industrialization. And so effectively, the drive towards industrial food, you know, the promotion of industrial foods over the 20th century, if you think about it, you know, what we eat today, what is common in the supermarket today, most of it, most of the food that is considered normal today is industrial stuff invented in the last 100 years, which our bodies for millions of years before did not eat. So why did we start introducing all of these industrial stuff? And if you look at it, you know, the production of these things has been largely highly subsidized all over the world. Almost every government in the world subsidizes the production of crops that are cheaper to produce because they want to, you know, meet the demands of their people for cheap food, basically. So they're always trying to tell their people, you know, don't worry about it, eat beans and eat soy and eat corn. And, you know, they try to promote the industrial foods. And if you look at the U.S. in the 1970s, there was a big drive towards the industrialization of food. And the U.S. Department of Agriculture subsidized heavily the production of large-scale farms, and they got all the small farms to be bought out. They gave preferential subsidy and credit to large farmers. So the drive towards centralization of farming and large-scale farming and the production of heavily industrial foods was heavily subsidized by government. And I don't think that that can be understood outside of the fact of government control of money. I suspect this might be a little bit alien if you haven't read my book, but a big chunk of my book discusses the importance of the consequences of government control of the money supply and what it allows government to do. In other words, it allows governments to carry out much more intervention in the economy. And in the 20th century, they've intervened quite heavily in the food market, and that came at the expense of promoting these terrible foods. And so as you start questioning your government's economic viewpoints and you start questioning their dietary viewpoints, you know, there's a certain personality that it takes, I think, to believe government in general on both perspectives. And there's a certain personality that's likely to disbelief on both perspectives. So that's why I think, you know, you find a little bit of a correlation on both topics. Because, you know, government dietary advice, if you read into the topic over the past 30, 40 years all around the world, the promotion of industrial oils, seed oils, the promotion of grains, the promotion of plant proteins, these are arguably at the root of the global diabetes and obesity and cancer epidemics all over the world. These particular foods, sugars, flours, grains, all of these things that can be manufactured at scale, they are the things making people sick. And those things are heavily subsidized by government. And I think that's, you know, that's a huge catastrophe. And, you know, there's a bit of a coincidence that in that the people who are able to see this connection, I think, in food will see it in economics. And so it changes your perspective on nutrition from being, okay, what is it that the government tells me versus what is actually better for my body? And so you try different things. And I think, you know, in my personal experience, and I think a lot of the experience of many other people, but I don't really like to get into debate on nutrition. I prefer to only talk about the economics of it because I really don't care what anybody eats. Let me just be clear. You know, I'm not trying to tell you what to eat. Please eat whatever you want. And I genuinely don't want to argue about diets, but I think the economics of it is the interesting aspect of it. And I think in a world in which we have a harder money, people are likely to... Oh, the other connection, and the other important one, is the issue of soil quality. When money is hard, and money is expected to gain value over time, money itself serves as a store of value that is likely to appreciate. So people are using that as a store of value. But when you don't have a safe haven store of value that can maintain value over time reliably, and the money that you use for daily transactions, the most liquid asset, is expected to devalue over time, then all of your attempts to save for the future are likely to have to be investments which involve risk. And so therefore, you don't have that ability to have something that's stable. And so therefore, you the likelihood of you having a return in the future becomes more, and you know, you lose the ability to have a guaranteed positive or at least constant return. Effectively, it leads to a higher time preference. In other words, it leads to higher discounting of the future. And this is a connection that I discuss in depth in chapter 5 of my book, possibly my favorite chapter. And you can also understand it through interest rates. Rise in interest rates, interest rates when they're manipulated downwards through an increase in the money supply, that brings about, it makes people more likely to borrow and less likely to save, right? So long-term thinking is encouraged through being able to hold value to the future. So the impact on soil is that people, if they don't have the ability to save for the future, and if their money is expected to lose value, then you have the incentive to discount the future heavier. And so therefore, when you have a piece of land, you're more likely to make decisions that are beneficial today at the expense of the future. And that's essentially what monocrop agriculture is. You take a fertile piece of land and you deplete it of nutrients into cropping for a few years, and it produces a lot of profit in the short run. But in the long run, it destroys the soil, and then you need constant input of fertilizer to continue to make it fertile again, and continue to produce food from it. So on the other hand, the grazing animals doesn't produce a lot of income in the short run, but in the long run, it maintains the soil of the health. The health of the soil, because animals are the best thing. You know, the natural cycle of soil and animal and plant is that the animals eat the plants, and then their poop fertilizes the plants, and their hooves stick into the land, and they do what the farmers do. The farmers till the land and add fertilizer. Well, animals do that naturally, and they provide free ribeyes along with it. So it's really the optimum technology for soil maintenance, as well as the optimum technology for nutrition. And on the other hand, the choice of going towards these mass-produced crops is disastrous for health and disastrous for the soil. And it's arguably, I think, an outcome of high time preference policies, high time preference decision making, which I don't think you can separate from inflationary monetary policy and from easy money as a phenomenon.
All right. Awesome.
Thanks.
All right, guys. Let's go over to Q&A. Leo, you want to help us out? Yeah. We'll turn the mic on.
Thank you, guys.
This way, it'll maybe pick up the audio on our mics, but we'll try to repeat the questions as well.
Make the first question a long one so I can catch my breath, please. Yeah.
Oh, you want the other mic as well?
There you go.
First question right here.
Sorry, I should have said. So you're saying that with the Bitcoin standard, we're going to have Bitcoin used more, or especially mainly for by large institutions.
No, not necessarily by large institutions. I'm saying that it's more comparable to transactions being done by large institutions, but I don't necessarily think that we'll end up in a world in which only large institutions run Bitcoin.
No, not only that. Maybe mainly.
Specify on that point? I'll just say that what Bitcoin allows us to do is to make the final layer of settlement much more decentralized. How much more decentralized is anyone's guess? But currently, the final layer of settlement amongst banks in the world ultimately settles in New York, in the New York Fed, you know? So if you want to send money anywhere from anywhere to anywhere in the world, ultimately there's only one full node in the fiat monetary system. To use Bitcoin language, there's only one full node. Only one person in the entire world is able to say they run a full dollar node, and that is the U.S. Federal Reserve. So they're the ones that are able to settle transactions. Bitcoin allows us a system in which, you know, right now we have tens of thousands of nodes. Potentially, I think in the future we could have many hundreds of thousands of nodes. Potentially, who knows what the capacity is. But the point is that each one of these is equal on a peer-to-peer network. None of them can change the monetary supply like the dollar full node can, and none of them can censor transactions like the dollar full node can. So how many of these end up being, don't fight with me. I tell people about what number it ends up. I don't know what the number is going to be, and I'm not like, it's like I'm calling for this to be you know, a certain number. I just think the economic reality dictates we're not going to have every transaction settled on a shared ledger with everyone in the world. I'm not going to carry every transaction by 7 billion people in the world on my phone. I have better things to put on my phone. I'm not going to spend bandwidth and processing power on it. So for, and it's an unnecessary level of security for daily transactions, as we were discussing earlier. Yep.
My question is actually towards that, if the system can be captured, if I mean, the, since, you know, we're going to have an amount of nodes, a lot of them would be institutions, right? That's institution. So what prevents the system from, like, eventually evolve with regulation into a system like we have today? So, you know, the, is first we have the gold standard, then we have fractional, first we have the Bitcoin standard, we have fractional Bitcoin standard, then we remove the Bitcoin, we just have fractional reserve, but with nothing. So.
Yeah, that's an excellent question.
Yeah, no, it's one of my favorite questions as well, because gold was somewhat decentralized until it was, the government realized that all the gold is sitting at the banks, and then one phone call and 80% of the gold is confiscated from the banks, and there goes the gold decentralization, and then gold eventually got removed. How do you prevent that from happening in Bitcoin in the future?
I think, you know, answering this question is understanding the whole point and the whole value proposition of what Bitcoin is. I'm not saying Bitcoin, the answer is that Bitcoin will resist those things. I'm saying Bitcoin was designed precisely with this end goal in sight. It's resisting that fate. So, you know, when we think about all of the fascination with blockchain technology, for me, the reason I find this stuff so silly is that the reason that, you know, we use all of this really complicated structure is not because the structure is in any way good for any particular resource, for any particular use of speed or efficiency or any of the things that many people think Bitcoin provides. It's good for one thing only: resisting capture by government. That's what it's optimized for. It's built to make your government angry, basically. That's what it does best. And so the key point is that in the case of gold, I see, really, for me, the key metric is this. I didn't mention this in my book, and it probably, you know, actually, to go back to your question, this would be, you know, if I'd added like a section specifically outlining this as a model, think of it this way. The cost of running a gold full node is much higher than the cost of running a Bitcoin full node. And so gold, having to move gold physically around as a form of payment, became essentially untenable when we moved towards a large globalized economy where most transactions are happening on a global scale. In that world, the monetary system became based not on the gold, but on the banks that are able to settle gold around the world. That became, settling gold around the world became as valuable as gold almost. And these banks became more and more centralized because moving gold around is very expensive. So what Bitcoin does is allows us to do, Bitcoin allows us to have 500,000, 1,000,000, 2,000,000 movements of gold all around the world instead of the, you know, the alternative, which would be arguably, you know, if you had 2,000,000 ships around the world shipping physical gold or airplanes going around the world, you know, there's about 200,000 flights, I think is the record for how many flights we've had around the world. So imagine trying to move, you know, that's the maximum flights that take place every day. So that's the maximum on-chain capacity for gold, for moving gold around. You know, if you made every flight in the world a mechanism for settling gold between cities in which the flights take place, and you use that as settlement payments around the world, the maximum on-chain capacity for scaling gold.
Yeah, gold isn't exactly light.
And it's not light, exactly. It takes up a lot of oil, energy to move it around. That's really the on-chain scaling capacity, and the cost of running a full node is much, 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 much more expensive. Particularly if you ignore just the operational cost and you think of the political cost, which is that you need to have an army to resist the American government, which can be expensive, probably. So really running a gold full node is far more susceptible to control by government. And that's ultimately the key thing is, governments controlled, the governments moved off the gold standard because they confiscated gold. Governments own today about a sixth of the entire supply of gold. They don't own a sixth of Bitcoins. Can they? Will they? I think it's harder with Bitcoin. I'm not saying it's guaranteed to happen. And that's why, you know, I tell people Bitcoin is still a speculative guess. It may succeed, it may fail. And I don't think you should bet your life savings on Bitcoin. I certainly don't. It may succeed, it may fail. It's built from somebody who understands the failure of gold or the move away from gold from an Austrian perspective. If you ask a Keynesian, why did we move off the gold standard? They'll tell you it's because gold failed, because there's not enough of it. We ran out of enough gold, and you know, we needed something easier. So we made this artificial form of tungsten called paper, and now we have a lot more money and we're richer. That's the Keynesian story. If you think that's the problem with gold, then you don't do Bitcoin. But if you think the problem with gold was that governments capture it and governments capture the central bank and capture the banking system, then you build a system that's built for decentralization, for thousands of nodes around the world. And you know, the technical reality of whether governments can destroy it or capture it are, you know, they're dynamic. They're not set in stone. Who knows how technology evolves? And you know, it's the market that's going to decide these things. The market is just a process of discovery where we are discovering what's going on. And it's a process of price discovery where the price essentially reflects the sum judgment of the participants of the market. Well, not exactly the sum judgment, but the judgment of the participants of the market on the value of Bitcoin and on its ability to do this job.
All right, let me just throw two quick comments in there on everything you said, which was great. Government does probably own about 1/6 of the gold. Now, I think it would have been a lot larger percentage. They used to own a lot larger percentage because government is the biggest seller of gold to the regular people. Most of the gold you actually buy it from the government, because by now they've realized that no one cares about gold, so they're happy to sell it. If there was serious global demand for gold, they would have held on to more than 1/6. And this is what worries me personally, of all the people that use companies like Coinbase and refuse to hold on to their own private keys, because if half of all the Bitcoin is being held by Bitcoin banks and underlying a Bitcoin ETF, and again, most of that revolves around a single government being the US, one phone call and the government does have a quarter of all the Bitcoin because they can confiscate it from centralized institutions.
Yeah, well, I think the thing is with I'm sorry, the first part of your question, I was...
That was a comment to your question.
What was it about? I want to say something about it. Sorry, I lost my thought.
The government could have had more gold if they weren't selling it to the people, because nobody cares.
Yes, the point that I wanted to make is, well, I disagree. It's not true. Governments are buying gold overall. At least they're reporting that they're buying gold. But we're never really sure how much of their official numbers on gold, because they don't always announce their buying and selling. And sometimes they announce it years later. So you find out today that this government bought gold 3-4 years ago. They're not very open about it. So we don't really know exactly how much gold they have. But the reality of the matter is government's monetary ability to make their own money, it depends on them holding gold. If people didn't care about gold, governments would have dumped it and sold it on the market and its price would have tanked. But that's not what would happen. If they put it on the market and gold is a free market, and if the movement of gold is free, in other words, if there's a free market in the ability of people to set up banking institutions built around gold, arguably over time gold will outcompete government's shitcoins, just like it's outcompeted government's shitcoins all throughout human history. Sure, you know, your government's shitcoin will last a few years or decades, but eventually, you know, it's just going to add more and more zeros on its bills, and gold is going to continue to be gold. And so, you know, governments need to maintain gold in their reserves. They maintain it because they don't trust each other, because ultimately they can't hold each other's papers as reserves. That's the problem with an international monetary system built around government money, that they have to trust each other. So, and that's unworkable. You know, all of the world's tensions come from the fact that all of these governments have all of these reserves of dollars and treasuries, and the US is producing essentially pieces of paper and selling it to the world. And that's, you know, the root of all of the imbalances of the world is the fact that the US government is the central bank of the world and it's producing money for the rest of the world. And so if you replace that with a hard asset rather than debt, rather than government debt, then you would have a monetary system that, you know, would be sane and would be strong. And I think in a free market, this is what would happen.
All right, let's jump over to another question. So it's a question about Jim Rickards and his concept of currency wars, but he's not that much into gold. He's more into the drawing rights of the IMF.
No, Jim Rickards is a total gold bug. I think you're mixing them up. He talks about the SDRs as the IMF's sort of conspiracy against gold or something like that.
Right, but that's what he sees as the future.
Yes, but also you have to remember he's shilling his own bags. So there's that. And also, you know, he's one of the people who believes in the blockchain technology as part of an international conspiracy by the IMF to bring SDRs as the global settlement payment. And if you've ever dealt with blockchain technology, you know that's not happening ever. Once the IMF people find out what blockchain technology actually is, it's not happening. In any case, the problem with this argument from Rickards is that, you know, first of all, Bitcoin's only been around for 10 years. If you had the bond market develop over Bitcoin in 10 years, I mean, come on, that's insane. That's like a four-year-old curing a cancer or something. Give it some time. But, you know, obviously time is not something people think about a lot these days. Second thing is, you know, if you think about how much time it took gold to develop a bond market on top of gold, it took many more than 10 years. So the second point is that gold. Yes, so I'm coming to that. Yes. So if you think about it, gold was chosen as money because it has the lowest growth rate of anything in the world. Okay, gold has the lowest reliable growth rate of anything in the world, at least for the next few years. If Bitcoin survives, gold is still going to have the lowest growth rate of anything until the next few years. But all throughout human history, every year we increase the supply of silver by 5%, 10%, 20%, the supply of copper by 30, 40, 50, 60%, and then we burn it, you know, we use it up and it rusts. So everything gets increased over time. Gold is the one thing whose supply increases the least. And so it won a monetary role all over the world because it was the thing whose supply increases the least. And so to then watch gold bugs like Jim Rickards turn around and start shouting like Keynesians and say that the problem with Bitcoin is that its supply doesn't grow fast enough. You know, well, if that was correct, then gold obviously is insufficient for a bond market. You know, obviously you need a Keynesian bond market. Obviously the best bond market in the world then is in Venezuela. And, you know, I'm sure the Venezuelan bond market has made enormous returns. More trillionaires.
Exactly.
So, you know, it goes back. It's sad, really, to see these supposed Austrians turn back to Keynesian arguments about we don't have enough money, we need inflation, and that's why we can't have Bitcoin. We need more and more inflation. And sadly, in the case of Rickards, you know, I'll be honest about it. It makes me stop taking him seriously because I realized, you know, it's not for him. He doesn't really, I don't think he gets the economics. He's just basically selling conspiracy theories and stories about his sources in the NSA and CIA, you know, allowing him to publish all this secret information and sell it on Amazon for $16.99. And, you know, giving him more information for the next book, you know, not killing him or investigating him or anything. He just continues to release all this information, which every time comes back to buy gold from his website. And, you know, essentially, I think that it's a sales pitch rather than any kind of real analysis. When he comes up with this kind of idea that Bitcoin's not going to develop a credit market because the money supply doesn't grow enough, and in an economy in which the supply doesn't grow fast enough, you know, arguably under the gold standard, the economy grew faster than the supply of gold grew many times during the period between 1870 and 1890, and now is a period of uninterrupted economic growth. Largely all over the world, particularly in Europe and the US, where we have reliable data, you know, even Milton Friedman looks at that period and he says, you know, I don't remember the exact quote, but something along the lines of, it's strange that there was no increase in the money supply and yet the economy grew and things were fine and there was no recession. But, you know, aw shucks, you know, shit happens and move on to the next chapter. Don't ask too many questions when they don't fit your theory. So they move on from these, the fact that an economy can grow with a, faster than a money supply, and that it's not a problem. Because it's not a problem. All that happens is the value of money goes up compared to goods and services, which is great for people. It's what you want. It's why you hold money, to store value over time. And it means that the quality of life is improving. And if we'd had that throughout the 20th century, arguably our quality of life today would be far higher, I think, than where it actually is today.
Yeah, I stopped listening or watching records probably about 3 or 4 years ago.
Yeah.
And I've been giving all the gold bugs a hard time. And then I guess I got him confused with, because all I heard him say was the IMF drawing rights and the conspiracies and the NSA.
Yeah.
And it just gets out of hand. It really, really does. And when these guys go so far into towards that delusion, they can never admit they're wrong, because everything they've done, like their entire financial career, depends on them doubling down and doubling down their position.
The question was, what is the catalyst for a nation state to buy Bitcoin, and what are the ramifications of it? I discussed the possibility in my book, and I discussed, you know, why, how it could happen and why it might happen, and why, you know, in a case where governments might be interested in it as an alternative settlement mechanism that is outside the scope of U.S. control. So, for instance, it might be possible for Iran and Korea and countries suffering from sanctions from the U.S. and unable to have full access to the SWIFT payment network, they can start settling their own payments with one another with Bitcoin. And, you know, there is a case to be made that maybe that is the case, but that might happen. But I think I remain skeptical of the possibility of this happening, which is why, you know, even though I discuss it in my book, I generally lean more towards what I have in the title of the book, which is the Bitcoin standard as the decentralized alternative to central banking, and not Bitcoin as a tool of central banks. And the way that I see it is that likely we're going to witness the development of central banking and Bitcoin as parallel ecosystems, you know, DVD and VHS, if you want, just incompatible systems that don't really work with one another, because I think Bitcoin is not very suitable to what central banks' mental models of money is. You have to think about it that, you know, to get a job in a central bank as an economist or as a policymaker in a central bank, you have to be heavily heavily submerged in the idea that money is a construct of the state. And so the idea that governments are going to legitimize something that was created by evil anarchists who don't believe in governments on the internet and make that their official currency, I think is a little bit too far. And I think that's probably best for Bitcoin. I think that's better for Bitcoin to continue to grow as an alternative to the central banks. You know, let the newspapers and, you know, stay with their dirty, yucky paper and ink, and let the websites bloom. And, you know, it's probably better for Bitcoin to grow as an alternative system away from government control for a while. And I think, you know, over time, the idea behind my book is that if Bitcoin is hard money and it continues to become to grow at a slower and lower rate over time, it likely appreciates more and more, rewarding the people who use the system at the expense of people, or not at the expense, rewarding the people who use this, while at the same time, people who use the other kind of monetary system witness the value that they hold in it decline over time. So, you know, we'd likely, if Bitcoin continues to offer itself as a better alternative, it could grow and eventually maybe displace the central banking system, or at least that's the plan, but don't tell anyone. but let them find out on their own. I think, you know, the last people to believe that this is going to happen are the central bankers. And that's why, you know, let's keep it that way. Let's, you know, we shouldn't fight with the no coiners. The more you hate Bitcoin, the more you didn't, you know, hopefully the later you join Bitcoin and the later you come to the party and we get to enjoy all the fun activities of Bitcoin before all the no coiners have to come and they have no other choice.
All right, Saif, thank you so much. Yeah, we're going to, we still have about, what, 30 minutes, 25 minutes? We're going to do a little networking session. Saif will still be here. You still have your books?
Yes.
You're able to sell a couple of books?
Yes.
Perfect.
And you'll sell cash or Bitcoin.
Yes, for cash or Bitcoin. And I'm sure he'll sign them for you. So you have a Patreon where people can also sign up and contribute?
Yes. So basically, I'm in order to spend more time writing about Bitcoin, if you'd like me to write more about Bitcoin, you know, subscribe to my newsletter where I produce a newsletter every month, like one on the energy and one on food. Also a couple on, you know, central banks and whether they could and how monetization could happen in the case of Bitcoin, hyperinflation or not, and why I think hyperinflation is not very likely. So the idea is that I would work on these monthly, send them out as to subscribers. And then by the end of the year, you know, if you can wait, if your time preference is low enough, you can pirate the book online. It's not a problem. But if you'd like me to write faster, contribute now and subscribe on Patreon or subscribe by Bitcoin as well, too.
All right. Thank you so much. And you can find Seyfa Dean on Twitter as well.
Thank you.
Thank you. I am Tone Vase. You can find me on YouTube and Twitter as well.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much for watching. Thank you very much for coming. I want to say thank you, especially to the Zen Spark for hosting us tonight. Do drop by again. They have a meetup group. They have a Telegram channel.
Oops.
Plenty of events that we're going to host over the next month, especially the Lightning Hack Day on March 30 and March 31. Here in Hong Kong, 2 days, all about the Lightning Network. Even if you're not a programmer and just want to learn how to set up a node and tinker with the network, we will set you up. That's it for now. Come if you already have the book, I'm sure Seth will sign it. If you don't, buy one, and the rest of us will mingle up. We have the space, I believe, until like 8 o'clock. So
all right, perfect. We have 25 minutes. Thank you so much for watching, guys, online, and we'll see you guys soon. I'll see you guys on the next podcast. I am flying out to Zurich tonight, so may or may not be a price video. We'll find out at the airport. Later, guys.